Thanks for calling Toyota. This is Jan.
I just adopted a new best friend, and I'm looking for a Toyota so we can make the most out of summer.
With a new RAV4, you can take your pup for a drive up the coast. You can take a Prius to the park, or you can take a Tundra to kayak at a remote lake.
One problem, Jan.
Oh?
My new best friend's a cat.
Your summer starts here, but it all ends June 3rd. Toyota, let's go places. Dealer inventory may vary. See your participating Toyota dealer for details.
Visit your Front Range Toyota stores today. Toyota, let's go places.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
If you live in the South Metro area and have been looking for top-notch customer service, extensive beer, wine, and spirit selections, and unbeatable prices, look no further than Davidson's Beer, Wine, and Spirits. You won't find a more varied inventory anywhere else. Don't just take it from me, guys. This is Michael, and he's been shopping at Davidson's since they opened.
The thing I like about Davidson's versus the competitors, it has a larger selection. And if I am going to buy spirit, then Davidson's is usually my first choice as well because just of the size of the selection. I also like the extensive selection of some hard-to-find items.
But that's not all. Every department is staffed with highly trained specialists who can help you find exactly what you're looking for.
I've always found the folks that you chat with to be knowledgeable. I've chatted with the spirits staff about different bourbons and different vodkas, and I am always chatting with the wine staff about different things and saying, I like this. What else do you have that's similar? Particularly when I go to non-U.S. Wines, I find them extremely helpful in helping me find something I'm looking for.
What are you waiting for? Head to either of their locations in Centennial or Highlands Ranch and follow them on Facebook to stay up to date on their latest specials.
And this ball in the air, deep right center field.
Two-run home run, Trevor Story.
Way back, Myers, watch it go. Chuck Nasty.
Two-run home run, David Dahl.
Nolan drives this high in the air, deep left field. Take a good look. You won't see it for long.
I don't want to lose your love tonight.
Welcome into the BSN Rockies podcast presented by The Green Solution. Visit any one of their 17 Colorado locations or browse their entire inventory online at mygreensolution.com. Reserve products online and pick up at your local TGS Express checkout. You'll be in and out in minutes. Use code BSN20 for 20% off your entire purchase. Now, let's jump into the show. So we've got a special treat for you today, and I don't want to delay it for too long, but I do want to give this just a little bit of setup because it's going to be a two-part episode, and there's going to be a couple of abrupt times where I just jump in and send us to commercial here because I had a lot of people from the press box that I enjoy talking to every single day that I wanted to get their thoughts on this article I'd written, but a lot of other things inside of it, and then we got on a huge tangent about analytics, and I couldn't really get control of the conversation, nor that I necessarily want to. It gets a little heated in here. I want everyone to know that immediately after this conversation, Manny Randhawa and Tracy Ringlesby went out to dinner together, so everything is fine. But this was really, really fun. Honestly, some of the most fun I've ever had doing a podcast for you guys. Thomas Harding drops by for a little bit. Unfortunately, we didn't get Patrick Saunders, but Kevin Henry, Tracy Ringlesby, Manny Randhawa, Ed Henderson, Patrick Lyons hopped on there for a minute. You'll hear his voice. I never really introduced him to the conversation, but a lot of stuff to talk about here. So like I said, it's going to be a two-part episode with a couple of abrupt commercial breaks, and the ending is just going to be in the middle of our conversation because I didn't want to stop us. Two parts. Hopefully you'll enjoy both episodes as much as I did. Let's get right into it. All right, I am your host, Drew Kreisman, and with me today, a truly all-star panel of guests. We're going to be talking a little later on with Tracy Ringlesby and Patrick Saunders. We're hoping that we can track down Thomas Harding and get him to join the conversation at some point. Just a few moments from now, we'll be joined by Kevin Henry of Rockspile, but sitting with me at this very moment, our good friend and many-time guest on the podcast, Manny Randhawa of MLB.com, and first-time guest on the podcast, which is beyond me why that is true, truly a superstar of the press box. It's because we always end up talking wrestling, I think, is maybe the big point. But,
that's it. Yeah, we're not going WWE on this. No. Okay.
We might get some in there.
We might. Yeah, why not? You know?
But a longtime insider for 850 KOA and a 26-year career as a scout in baseball, Ed Henderson, man, thanks so much for joining us, Tom. This is going to be a great conversation because we've got a lot of different perspectives, and I'm going to set it up here and try to not make it as self-serving as it legitimately is, because I wrote a huge piece and now I'm going to make all of my friends in the press talk about it. But I think it's one thing, it's been a very frustrating year for people that watch the Rockies, for people that cover the Rockies, but one thing that unites everybody is frustration over this thing. Whatever it is that is the topic of conversation today, I've started to call it the margin of error, the Coors Field effect, the Coors hangover effect, it's been called before. The narrative that surrounds this team that sometimes makes it next to impossible for them to get a fair amount of recognition, whether it's MVP voting, Cy Young voting, or as we've seen with the biggest example, spoiler, number one on the list was Larry Walker, at maybe not making it into the Hall of Fame. We're all hoping he does. I think everyone at this table is going to be making a big push to hope that that happens. But let's begin with the big ones so that then we can go back and kind of look at the more nuance, because Todd Helton and Larry Walker get the most ink. But Ed, for you, is there a particular part of this Larry Walker puzzle, and now as Helton has started to come into the Hall of Fame voting conversation, that just puzzles you as somebody who's seen a lot of baseball everywhere, but also particularly here?
Yeah, I would think this is one of the stranger things that I've run into, to be honest with you, with a gentleman who had monster numbers when he was with Montreal. He comes here, was an immediate impact player here. He's been an immediate impact player everywhere he's played. Expos, Rockies, Cardinals. His numbers, and you guys know it much better than I do, his numbers now stretch way past some of those individuals who are currently in the Hall of Fame. So I think what puzzles me more than anything else is this constant nonsense, and I'm going to use the term crap, that surrounds the fact that if you played at Coors Field, we have to take points off for that. So here's my argument to it, very simply. You can't take points away when he's on the road. You can't take points away when he's playing for another ball club. So in the case of Larry Walker, if you measure the entire body of work, I think anybody who knows anything at all about baseball and the value of a particular athlete to the game has to admit that Walker belongs in the Hall. End of story.
Well, Manny is literally writing the book on not just that, I think that's a big part of it, but on the Blake Street Bombers, and has done as much work and research on any of this, probably even more than me, really, in terms of certainly putting the numbers together.
I would presume that's the case.
At least we both spend a lot of time on this, yeah. That's for sure. But what do you can you put a little bit of numbers to what Ed just said?
Yeah, Ed's encapsulated it. It's Larry Walker is giving us the. The quintessential example of this, right? The whole Coors bias, if you want to call it that. Because he's up for the Hall of Fame and because the numbers scream Hall of Famer. And I'm talking about park-adjusted numbers. There are still people, you go on Twitter, you'll find them pretty quick. People who argue that the Coors effect somehow detracts from what Larry Walker did. Larry Walker's park-adjusted numbers are better than many, many Hall of Famers who are in there already.
Vladimir Guerrero.
Vladimir Guerrero is the kind of case study here because Fangraphs wrote an article about this. Many people have written about it, talked about it. If you vote Vladimir Guerrero, you can't not vote for Larry Walker because I think Guerrero played 100 games more or 150 games more. Mm-hmm. And Larry Walker, his OPS plus, which is on-base plus slugging, adjusted for Coors and adjusted for every ballpark.
Harshly, by the way.
And as
you and I have been into that.
Yeah, and as Drew will get to later, potentially over penalizing the Rockies here, was 141. So 41% better than the league average during his career. And Vladimir Guerrero, who was inducted, 2 years ago, 140. If you look at the wins above replacement, which is also park adjusted, and remember Larry Walker was a 7-time Gold Glove winner. Larry Walker's career, let's start here. I was talking to Larry for the book, and he said, I don't know if I'll make it in, but it'd be cool to go in with Jeter, because Derek Jeter is going to go in first ballot, no problem.
Yeah.
And Larry Walker has a career Baseball Reference WAR per 162. So if you divide it by 162 games, so it's 5.9 per season. That's a star, superstar player.
Every year.
That's average, 5.9. So six WAR a year. That's superstar level. Derek Jeter's in almost, I want to say 700 or 800 more games, something like that, 4.3. So he is giving you 4 wins a year, and Larry's giving you 6. And Derek Jeter will be celebrating as he walks up to that podium this next summer. And Larry Walker will be scratching and clawing to get to 75%. So however you slice it or dice it, Larry Walker is a Hall of Famer. If you want to try to argue that he's not, that's a very, very difficult argument to make. You can't make it number one. It's a very difficult one to defend. And so, in any way, shape, or form, all you have is the raw numbers are inflated, of course. 1997, he had a 1.169 OPS at home. His OPS on the road was 1.176. He had 49 home runs, of which 29 came on the road. This guy was a special talent. I talked to a lot of people for this book. I talked to Tony La Russa a couple days ago, managed him in St. Louis. And La Russa said, he said he is the best of the outstanding. I talked to Tim Wallach, who Larry says is his favorite teammate of all time, and played with him in Montreal. And he said, look, Wallach said, everyone knows about the hitting, the Gold Gloves and everything. Best base runner I ever saw.
Yeah.
No question, no contest. And there's just more and more of this. So many people have talked about this. Jim Leland, the Rockies put this out. Jim Leland managed Barry Bonds and said, Larry Walker's the greatest player I've ever seen. I mean, if you're going to argue that Larry Walker's not a Hall of Famer, you've got a lot to go up against based on all of that. So we'll probably get into more of it, but the numbers scream it, and if you saw him play, that screams it too.
Well, and I think one of the reasons why I put this all together was because we see a lot of the same elements of the Walker case and all of these other things that have happened. And I think when you put them all together, this pattern emerges because you can start to justify one thing or the other. It's hard to justify all of them, right? So Kevin has joined us now from Rockspile. We're very excited to have you, Kev. Before we, if there's anything else you want to throw in on the Walker thing, or is there any other particular case to maybe jump us into some others where you go, hey, if not Walker, then what about this guy?
Yeah, all the stuff that I've read from Manny, and I mean, you talk about chanting for Walker. I mean, I hope that when he gets in, and when he gets in, that it's recognized how much Manny's done to really push that. And how I've seen so many people on the Twitterverse hop in on that too. That's been one of the coolest things I've seen. It's been a down season, we know all that, but seeing how Walker has been celebrated now, I think that it's amazing to see the groundswell he's starting to get, and obviously we still have a little ways to go and a lot to push, but Manny deserves big kudos.
I appreciate that, Kevin.
Yeah.
I think it's more really the egregious nature of him not being in 9 years ago, and the fact that he's down his 10th year. You just look at make the Jeter comparison, and it's just stark, it's clear. He's going in, no problem. Larry Walker's going to struggle, right? So that whole thing is what kind of makes you passionate about, you know, I'm not a Rockies fan. I didn't grow up a Rockies fan. But Larry Walker is an absolute Hall of Famer, and for him not to get in would be a travesty. I think that's what pushes this whole thing.
And Yankee Stadium will never get the brunt of the cooler stakes.
Right.
Minute Maid Park, I mean, that, I go back to that article that you wrote about 2 months. Yankee Stadium, God forbid you ever say anything bad about that stadium.
And just, and what Kevin's referring to is that Yankee Stadium, we took an article from a couple of years ago, basically taking a percentage of home runs hit in every ballpark that were quote-unquote cheap based on StatCast. So not barreled, not hit solidly. And curiosity began, obviously, with Coors and also Wrigley because of the wind. And it turned out that Coors was ninth on that list. Number two was Yankee Stadium. Number one, Houston with the Crawford boxes.
Let me jump in, too, if I may, Drew.
Absolutely.
From and add a scout perspective to this. I probably, in the time that I've been scouting here in Colorado, and in the time I've been covering the Rockies, probably seen, I'm going to say, in excess of 1,000 Major League games. I have no idea where the number is. There's two guys in my mind that stand out immediately in terms of their overall baseball instincts. One of them is the third baseman we have playing here now, and Nolan Arenado, and the other one is Larry Walker. And this is with all due respect to Helton, Galarraga, everybody else that's come along, you know, the Blake Street Bombers, Castilla, Burks, all of them. And I know we're going to talk more about some of those guys a little later. But I got to tell you, when I look at a guy and I can just see that in every facet of his game, he gets it. You talked about the Gold Glove and his base running. I saw him. I was here watching games when guys would try to stretch a single into a double, or a guy would take off from second thinking he could get to third, and Walker would just gun him down. They did it once. They didn't do it again. One time, and that was it. It was like lesson learned. He terrific baseball instincts, and to echo what all three of you gentlemen have said already, it's an absolute travesty that he's not in now. But it's going to be even worse if he doesn't get in soon. And you go the route of the Veterans Committee and having to go through all that process. Walker belongs. That's it. Plain and simple. End of story.
Absolutely.
And, you know, one of the things that I think we started to touch on there, Manny, in the conversation, too, is, and Ed said, well, okay, well, how can you hold what he did on the road against him, right? Well, fifth on my list of the most egregious moments was a weird one, because it was in 2016, Charlie Blackmon came in 26th for MVP. And I don't know that he should have been National League MVP that year, but that was the year. Now, we all got to be honest with this. Charlie's had some splits in his career.
That's what makes it so fascinating, is that some years he'll hit better on the road, some years he'll hit, I mean, the splits are terrible for the road part, and it's like, it's just kind of back and forth.
So in 2016, so we all know, he hit .324 overall, on base .381, slugged .552. On the road, he hit .313, on base .363, so very close, a little bit less, but very close, and still obviously very good. And he slugged more on the road at .563 over his .552 mark at Coors Field, which makes you wonder, first of all, how is that even possible? But second of all, how this really doesn't extend both ways. And this road problem is one of the biggest things that hasn't been understood. This Rockies being on a disadvantage when they go out to hit on the road. There are very few guys in history who've ever put up .313 on the road or slugged better on the road. And the OPS Plus and WRC Plus and stuff aren't giving you credit for that. So, and Nolan's come up against this a couple of times too. I was wondering if you guys had any other thoughts about the road hitting element of this whole thing.
To me, it's funny that, if I remember right, earlier this year, they highlighted the Dodgers and when they left Coors Field and what happened to them.
Yes.
You know, and it was like, it was
the
LA Times.
I was LA Times.
And all of a sudden, it was like that they just discovered, you know, nuclear fusion. It was like, oh my God. And then I remember you saying on Twitter, you know, imagine doing this all the time.
81 times a year, yeah.
So I'm glad that, I wish other markets, you know, I would love to see the Mets after they leave here next week and wherever they're going, what happens to them. You know, I would love to see teams in major markets start looking at what really happens and help get some of the word out there that, yeah, the Rockies are at a disadvantage because they do this all the time and we know that.
That's absolutely right, and that's where you go first. You look at the physical drain on the body of going from here down to sea level and then spending 7 or 8 days on the road, maybe 10 days on the road, and then coming back. You do that a dozen times a year on those road trips. And if you look at, if you go throughout Rocky's history, take all 26 seasons, find one, you will find one season that the Rockies were 500 or better, and that was last year.
Yeah.
And look, think about how many great players have come through here. Great hitters have come through here, in particular. And if you're telling me that there was one season that there were 500 on the road, and if you look at their actual individual stats, you will find virtually no one. I mean, Walker's an exception, you know. Charlie's an exception. Nolan's an exception. But virtually nobody, other than these kind of like star, superstar caliber players, were able to hit well on the road.
And Gerardo Parra for some reason.
Right, yeah, right. Well, Gerardo Parra is always the some
right.
reason.
Yeah,
he's a baby shark guy.
Yeah.
And so what I'm saying is, it's not personnel, right? You can go through two generations, basically, right? Actually, that's more like three generations of Rockies, right? And they all just hit poorly on the road. That means there's something else. There's an external factor, and that's got to be the altitude. And like you said, Drew, they don't get credit for that part. They only get the traction for that, and they get dinged for here. So, you know, what Charlie Blackmon did in 2016, slugging better on the road, 926 OPS on the road, what Walker did in 97, what Castillo did in 97, 98, over 800 OPS both years on the road. It's phenomenal. We don't even know. The science, at some point, somebody's going to start giving us more of the science behind this. But when we find out, we are going to absolutely, our jaws, we'll have to pick up our jaws off the floor at what these guys have done.
And on that day, we will all celebrate with a Breckenridge Brew, the official beer of BSN Denver. We will be very excited about the fact that somebody has come along and made some sense of all of this, and we will toast with vanilla porter or with oatmeal stout, with avalanche amber, of course, with strawberry sky, the agave wheat. I always leave out the agave wheat, and I'm not sure why. It's one I have often. I've sort of switched over to the strawberry sky for this summer, but a nice solid wheat beer, if that's what you're into. You can't go wrong with a nice beer from Breckenridge Brewery. So make sure you head over to our BSN Denver events calendar. See when the next watch party is going to be. See when the next time is. You're going to be able to find yourself into a nice 6-pack or 12-pack if you're having a nice weekend of Breckenridge Brew. Hey, we got to take a quick break. We'll come back on the other side of it and get Ed's response to what Manny just had to say.
Are you in search of natural relief from your daily stresses? Well, Strava Craft Coffee is a CBD-rich, hemp oil-infused coffee that is non-psychoactive, helps reduce pain naturally, keeps those coffee jitters away, and so much more.
I started drinking it because I have degenerative arthritis, and I would prefer to drink coffee that has natural ingredients in it for healing. And this coffee treats the inflammatory process that happens from having degenerative arthritis.
That was Robin. She's been drinking Strava Craft Coffee every day for months now, and she is so happy with the results.
I would recommend it to America, to everyone, because it is a fantastic product. It delivers, it does what it says it's going to do, and it's amazing.
Put your body back in balance with Strava Craft Coffee and see how good you feel. Order online today and use promo code BSN2018 for 20% off. That's BSN2018.
Hey, if you're like me, and you're trying to figure out how to be a mature, refined adult, or if you just really like wine, you have to check out my friends over at Weinster. Weinster is an innovative online direct-to-consumer wine club connecting wine drinkers with more than 110 of the best wineries in America today. What makes Weinster special is that the majority of the wineries they work with are too small to attract the attention of retailers, meaning not only are you getting access to some delicious and hard-to-find wines, you're also supporting real people making real wine, not one of the few large corporations producing most of the wines available in stores. With Weinster, all you have to do is sit back and relax as they curate a hand-picked shipment from the best small wine producers in the U.S. Then, when you fall in love with a couple of wines as a club member, you can have them sent right back to your door with no shipping costs. We especially love Weinster here because it was founded by three CU Boulder alums. So sign up today with the code BSN25 to get $25 off your first shipment of wine and start being a real grown-up. That's WineStyr.
You know, one component to it, guys, too, and it, Manny, you alluded to, you know, the fact that hitting at altitude, pitching at altitude, that comes into conversations all the time, as we know. What's interesting to me, and I've watched games both here and at sea level. One big factor here, as we know, pitchers will tend to stay away from the off-speed pitch. They'll tend to stay away from curveballs at Coors Field. So for these guys who get a steady diet of not seeing those pitches much here, then to be able to go on the road and perform and have it just flip the switch and they're successful, that to me is something even more amazing because, you know, during the course of a season, you know, these guys are working on their hitting every day in the cage, during BP and so forth. But to be able to go out and execute on the road and at Coors Field, but in particular on the road where they see a lot of fastballs here and it's velocity, velocity, velocity that gets emphasized here, pitching inside, coming inside on them with fastballs, not seeing much in way of sliders and curves all that much here. That really, to me, is a very telling factor.
Yeah, absolutely. The break on pitches, I mean, that's the other factor. It's a dual nature thing. I mean, you see one guy here, and then you go and play that team at home the next week, his breaking ball is all of a sudden wicked, and it was flat here. It's as simple as that.
You know, Dave Magoon was talking the other day about how they're throwing more curveballs down batting practice the first game of the road trip.
Yeah.
You know, just to get them back in that psychology of, like I said, heavy on the curves.
Dante would break out an actual pitching machine to simulate the break on pitches. You know, and he did that both, I think, as a player, and he did that when he's hitting coach, because he's like, that's the main thing, is that you got to figure out the break. You got to get used to it real quick.
So you brought a name into the conversation that allows me to bring a word into the conversation, because Dante Bichette and Vinny Castilla, I think, are the biggest victims of not recognizing how hard it is to be consistent. What I found is, like, Dante Bichette had one phenomenal year in his career. I could have made this about him not being MVP in 95, but really, when you look at it, that was kind of by far the best year of his career. Every other year, though, he's a 110 WRC plus guy, OPS plus, whatever. He's hitting 290 to 310 every year, no matter where he played. Vinny Castilla had five straight seasons of hitting at least 300 and 25 home runs. And Manny, you were the one who pointed out to me he had back-to-back years where he actually put up the exact same line, or
yeah,
what was it?
It was 96 and or 97 and 98, or I should say 96 and 97. He was 304 batting average, 343 slug, or 304 batting average, and 40 home runs at 113 RBIs. Bonus.
Exactly.
Exactly. Yeah, which is crazy.
And so you and got to see some of this stuff. I mean, I was watching. I was a kid. Let's be.
What are you saying, bro?
What are you trying to say? Every time Sledgehammer hit, I got excited.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Every time Crazy Train hit, I got excited. I remember what Vinny Castilla's walk-up music was. I'm sure it was fantastic. But Castilla and Bichette really do seem to be the guys people look back on and go, we thought they were good in the 90s, but that was just Coors Field. And when you look back on it, it's like, not even a little bit. They were too consistent to be products of the most volatile environment in baseball.
Yeah, absolutely. I think those were guys that, you know, they were the Blake Street Bombers, but they were doing a hell of a lot on the road too. And we saw what they were capable of. Vinny goes to Atlanta. You saw Dante with a career in other locations as well. Those two guys were always impactful players no matter where they were. So, again, we get back into that discussion of the Coors Field effect. You know, people forget these guys played with other ball clubs. They played half of the season on the road. It to me is an absolute travesty that factors in so much in the minds of the people who make these decisions. And when Manny was making the point earlier about the numbers contrast between Jeter and Walker, you listen to that and you think to yourself, well, is it because of where you know, Jeter played? Is it because of where Larry played? I think it is. I mean, not to take anything away from Derek Jeter, for God's sakes, but I mean, he was a phenomenal player in the game. But the bottom line is, okay, if you're going to give Jeter and you're going to give that East Coast grouping the benefit, that's fine. But give these guys the benefit, too, for the number of games they played on the road, especially on the road.
But, yeah, what if Derek Jeter had played in Seattle? You know, I mean, it's a really interesting thing because, you know, A-Rod, we knew of him, but all of a sudden he blew up whenever the Texas and, of course, the New York thing.
Right.
So it's absolutely true that it had a lot to do with it. And I will tell you, you know, I grew up outside Colorado, came here late, you know, got here as quick as I could. But I remember covering the Tulsa Drillers whenever they were the Double-A franchise. And one of the questions that was always asked of Nolan and everybody else who came up through there was, man, won't it be great to hit a Coors Field because the ball just flies there. So we even had the bias back then, you know, just going, oh, man, when they get the Coors, they're going to hit 120 home runs, you know. So we were perpetuating that a little bit just covering the minor leagues.
Right.
Won't it be great to win?
Yeah, I mean, with Dante and we're still on Dante and Vinny.
Dante and Vinny.
I went to get something to eat, so I'm chewing. Don't worry about it. Or I hope I'm clear. Tracy Ringlesby has joined us here too.
Yeah, Tracy has joined.
And you got it. When we get to Walker again, you got it. You got to ask him about the George Brett story. It's tremendous. But with Dante and Vinny, absolutely, those two guys I think are looked at, especially Bichette, as like the poster children, poster, you know, of Ronnie sluggers who came here and they were Coors creations. They became what they became because of that.
I hate that phrase so much, yeah, Coors creations.
Dante was a part-time guy. And by the way, Tracy was there for all of this, Rocky Mountain News. So, you know, he's got far more in the way of, you know, information and stories on this, but in depth on this. But Dante played for the, you know, he was drafted by the Angels. He was a very raw player. He was, you know, his parents supported his baseball, but they weren't like into it, you know. So, you know, he just, you know, the reason he started playing baseball because he saw Reggie Jackson hit a home run in Game 7 of the 1974 World Series, and it was just because the TV was on NBC, and his mom told him, oh, that's baseball, they get paid to do that. And he said, they get paid to do that? Okay, and then that was his goal for the rest of his, you know, the rest of his, you know, adolescence was to get there, you know. So he was very raw, and he basically gripped and ripped. That was his thing. Basically what people think of him as, that's what he was when he was coming up. Right when he was in high school, after high school he wasn't. And I'll tell a story that's going to be in the book. After high school, he didn't know what to do. You know, he just kind of sitting around a little bit, trying to think about what to do next. Hondo Wilkes, who was a youth coach of his, and he was always coaching him, helping him out all throughout his youth and up to high school, took him to Palm Beach Junior College, where Frank Cacciatore was the coach, and he ended up becoming, I think, a minor league manager in various places, and maybe a scout too. But he said, this guy wants to try out. You know, he just graduated from high school. And Cacciatore said, I don't need anything but a catcher now because I've the tryouts were yesterday. You missed it. And Dante, never having caught in his life, and Hondo standing next to him saying, yeah, he's a catcher. And so he said, all right, come here at 4:30 tomorrow morning to run. And if you're here, we'll give you a shot. So he did that. That afternoon, they played a scrimmage. He caught. He was behind the plate. Awful, as you'd expect.
Sure.
It was terrible. It was very bad. But that's what you'd expect. But when he got to the plate, he roped the ball to left field for an out in his first at-bat. And then he hit one over the light tower onto the racquetball courts in his second at-bat off a guy who ended up getting drafted in the major leagues. The catcher, Torrey, says, well, you're not a catcher, but we'll keep you. And so from then on, that's when the Angels started looking at him. But the point is that he was very raw, but then he became a student of the game. He read The Science of Hitting by Ted Williams every single year, over and over again, prior to the season. And he was a student of the game to the nth degree, and that's why if you look at him, you know, he valued other parts of the game other than just slugging, you know, going the other way, singling the other way. His two-strike approach is what he prided himself on. So there's much more to Dante Bichette than that. And Vinny Castilla, I'll just give you a stat for him. He's a fastball, dead red fastball hitter. Can't sneak cheese past the rat is what everybody would say about how he could hit a fastball. All three home runs he hit in the 1995 Division Series were off Braves pitching. Guys like Smoltz, and he hit one here in this building in game one off Maddox. All breaking balls. So, I mean, these guys are not one-dimensional by any means.
Trace, you got some Dante Bichette and Vinny Castilla for us?
Well, I guess because I grew up in Wyoming, and so I watched minor league baseball here, and I remember when I was with United Press International down here in the 70s, the teams that came through here, and somehow players like Dawson and Raines and Bryn Smith and Cromartie and Gary Carter, they all like developed playing at Mile High Stadium at altitude. And the one year they had the White Sox here, and Norm Babe was a manager, and Pete Vukovich was on the team, and they called the Vuk in at the end of July. He was my running mate at that time. I said, they wanted to take you to the big leagues. He goes, I need a commitment from them. He said, what? That I can come back down because I'm having fun here and we're going to the playoffs. I want to be part of the team in Denver. But, you know, Vukovich pitched here. Steve Dunning, who was a breaking ball, off-speed guy, won like 18 games here that year. So, I mean, I think it becomes an excuse for people to justify their failure. Do you have to just, you know, when Bill Guyvette was here and you couldn't throw a curveball, it was banned in the organization. So I saw Bert Hooten one day, who was a pitching coach at the time with the Astros, and I said, where did you learn the knuckle curve? I mean, I knew the answer to my question. Where did you learn the knuckle curve? He goes, oh, when I pitched for the Boulder Collegians for Baldy Machado, and you know, they taught it to me, the knuckle curve there. Well, I said, well, I thought you can't throw a curveball at altitude. He goes, who's stupid enough to believe that? I said, well, Bus Campbell isn't, that's for sure, because it's his pitch. He teaches everybody, and he's the one that taught you. And he goes, you know, you have to change your release point because you're not going to get as much break. But you don't need 2 feet. You can do it with 18 inches as long as you make sure that you have a lower release point with it. He said, Tracy, I pitched at Dodger Stadium, and every time I pitched, I had to make adjustments based off how I felt. That's what pitching's about. So I think, you know, sometimes we get a little carried away with looking for excuses for failure at the big league level because guys don't want to admit that maybe they had a bad night or they were overmatched. I mean, if you go back and you look at Mike Hampton, his first 2.5 months in Colorado, he was 9-2 with a 2.98 ERA.
Yeah.
I don't think he won 9 games the rest of the time he was here.
Yeah.
You know, but And I asked him about that when he was a bullpen coach in Seattle. We were talking about it. We were talking about the pressures that you face when you go someplace as a big-time free agent because they'd gotten the second baseman from the Yankees at that time. And he said, you know, I let it get to me in Colorado. I said, what? He goes, well, I wasn't getting as much sink on my sinker. I didn't have the break on my breaking ball. And so I started trying to do things instead of just worrying about winning. You know, and that's the bottom line, is worry about winning. And I really think, no one will ever admit it, but, you know, they don't have as many distance runners trained at this altitude anymore because they found out, Wyoming, like, they have a high altitude training thing in their new indoor practice facility there where you can have up to 7 guys in there and you can train at any level of elevation you want because particularly for the distance runners and stuff, they have trouble when they go to a lower elevation because the air is heavier and it's not as thin. And they have found out that it's a wives' tale to say that, well, you need to go to high altitude to train for conditioning purposes because you then have the negative effect and it takes a while. But you don't have the effect of altitude for over 24 hours. And then it's more dehydration than it is anything else. Rocky Long, who's now at San Diego State, he was at New Mexico, and he used to be an assistant coach at Wyoming. So he's been in the conference ever since he's left. His teams never arrive in Laramie before midnight. And they're going to pitch. It's like after midnight, the day that they're going to play in Laramie, because he wants to be out of there in 24 hours.
Yeah.
And he's had great success as a visiting coach up there. One time he got there at 5 in the morning because it was like blizzarding, and he kept having to circle, and they had a noon kickoff. It's when Joe Glenn was there, and Wyoming gets the ball the first time down, and they go the distance, and they're up 7-0. It's like, this is going to be great. It was a miserable day. In fact, Pistol Pete was on one of those plastic bobsleds. ESPN showed about 9 times in the upper deck. In the upper deck.
Going down the...
They beat him 42.
In the upper deck?
Yeah, New Mexico beat him 42-7.
All right. So you brought something up there. We're not going to get Manny, and I suppose now that I'm on the team all riled up about the win stat, but I did have to include a record in my art. There was one I could not overlook, and it goes along with the conversation we're having. Jorge De La Rosa pitched 583.2 innings at Coors Field to a 4.38 ERA, but his record was 53-20 here. And I think part of that, I'm going to throw out one more stat, and then I want to get everyone's opinions on what's going on here. Part of that may be also this. Here are some of the best pitchers. I just was looking for the best guys I can find and their careers at Coors Field. Clayton Kershaw, 133 innings pitched, 4.6 ERA. Madison Bumgarner, 100.2 innings pitched, a 4.56 ERA. Patrick Corbin, 61 innings pitched, a 6.20 ERA. Zach Greinke's probably handled it the best. 83 innings pitched, a 4.01 ERA. That's the only one that's better than De La Rosa.
But he doesn't know where he is.
Yeah, Zach Greinke has no idea where he is at any given time. Walker Buehler, 31.2 innings pitched in his young career so far, is a 5.12 ERA here. Max Scherzer, who's the best pitcher in the world most of the time, has 26 innings pitched here, 5.88 ERA at Coors Field. Steven Strasburg, 26 innings pitched, a 6.23 ERA here at Coors Field. Now, they obviously haven't had, you know, one or two games you come in, you get rocked, you wash it, you take a shower, you go somewhere else. They haven't had time to try to train and get used to it or even give it much thought. But, I don't know, does that tell us anything? Kevin, what do you think?
Great question. Honestly, I don't know if it tells us anything, honestly, because I think all the stuff that we know about sea level going back to altitude and everything else, I know other teams don't prepare for that like the Rockies do, obviously. And like you said, Scherzer isn't going to get that many opportunities that cool. Sometimes he's going to get skipped. You know, I hate to say that a lot of people will just look at those and shrug, but well, it's Coors Field. And I think there's a lot more to it than that. I certainly think that these teams aren't preparing coming in as much. They get prepared mentally, but still I think that we talk about the curveball and everything else and the perceptions that are out there. And sometimes they can get to a Mike Hampton, they can get to a lot of guys.
No, I think they're intimidated by the perception, and then they also have the easy excuse for failure. And
sure.
The easier it is for you to accept failure, the easier it is for you to fail.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay. And I think that becomes a thing. And you know, you don't necessarily have that badge of courage. And I'm gonna defeat this thing.
Kevin,
there's too many pitchers that pitched here. The Yankees had their farm system here.
Yeah.
I mean, they're gonna have their farm system in a bad place for the pitchers and stuff. I mean, the excuses that people come up with, it's just that. I mean, it's not even 320 feet down the line at Yankee Stadium.
Right.
And I mean, the old the
314,
Kingdom,
maybe.
Where the Mariners played in the Kingdom, it was 312. And in fact, they had to get special clearance to open that ballpark because the Angels go in to play the first game ever there. And David Garcia was third base coach. And they're working out the day before. It's going to be the first game ever at the Kingdom. And he says, how come you have, says the groundskeeper, how come it says 321? On that sign down the line. He said, well, it's 321 to the outfield, that's minimum requirements, and that's how we built it. He goes, I'd say it's closer to 310 feet than 321. They get into this big argument, so they get the tape measure out. It was 312 feet down the line. They had to scramble overnight to get permission from the league to play there because they had just put that rule in that it had to be 321. Nobody seemed to think that that was a knock on Edgar Martinez. Right, you know,
right.
And that was, I mean, pitchers hated that because not only did you have short fences there, but you had the AstroTurf. So the ball was, I mean, everything about it was a hitter's ballpark.
What Tracy's talking about here is exactly why the whole notion that Drew mentions in his article about baseball doesn't count here because it's just a joke or whatever.
That's the frustrating
part. That's what Tracy just said. That's why it does count, and that's why it's not a joke, because there have been ballparks throughout history. There's a Baker Bowl. There have been ballparks throughout history in which there have been extreme advantages or disadvantages for hitters.
You know, Fenway Park.
Fenway Park. AT&T. You know, a lot of people. For the book, I talked to Ellis Burks, and he had some of his best years of his career at age like 35, 36 in
San Francisco.
And he played 1 year at AT&T, the year it opened. I'm like, is it true, man? It's so hard to get there. And he said, we did fine.
I didn't have a problem.
Barry Bonds, Jeff Kent, Ellis Burks. And so what I mean to say is, some of it depends on your hitters. Yeah. And the Giants can't get anybody. I think the Giants just had their first 20 home run, a single season 20 home run hitter in like 4 years or 5 years.
Yeah. It doesn't help the narrative that the Rockies have been so much better in their history of getting good position players and have not been great at having good pitchers, and so that just makes the narrative,
also,
I think, that much worse.
Vinny Castillo said, he said, why can't everybody just do it then? Why can't everybody hit 45 home runs here every year?
Well, so the two parts...
Like Fenway, the other thing is like Fenway Park... Everybody thinks that it's a great hitter's park because of the monster. No, it's a great hitter's park because of right field. And
oh, yeah.
Yeah, because there's so much room out there to get base hits.
Yeah.
I mean, you talk about a joke. What about that piece of crap they have in Houston?
you missed our Minute Maid. Yeah. We were talking earlier, but yeah.
And they didn't even build. They got special permission to not build it to specification.
Right.
It's a joke. You don't know what a joke it is? Juan Pierre... hits a pop-up and slams his bat and breaks it. Now, Juan Pierre doesn't get upset.
Yeah.
He didn't realize it was his first career home run. He went oppo at Minute Maid Park and hit it into the left field. He thought he'd popped out to the left fielder in a crucial situation.
You know, Tracy said it earlier, and I think what this whole conversation touches on is the word adjustments, right? And when I hear people say, well, you can't pitch at Coors Field, excuse me? We've had, in this environment here, in this city, we've had Roy Halladay, Brad Lidge, David Ardsma, Kevin Gossman, some guys that have had some, you know, up and down.
Deuce
Gossage, absolutely.
He's having a down year, but let's also not throw Kyle Freeland out
of
that conversation.
So, you know, when people badmouth Coors Field or badmouth Denver, badmouth Colorado, and say you can't pitch there, I say that's utter nonsense. It's a matter of making adjustments. And as I tell people, and it sounds a little... sarcastic and obvious, but I mean, there's a winning pitcher in this ballpark every night, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it isn't always a Rockies pitcher, but the guys who have had success here, and you've listed some of them, Drew, they're the guys that figured out how to make the adjustments and come in here and be successful.
John Gray's got a 3.46 ERA at Coors Field this year, which has given up 5.25 ERA this year, and people talk like he's not a top-of-the-line type of guy or not pitching that way. The one on the list, the name I haven't brought up yet, that when I went back and was looking at game logs was 2010, Ubaldo Jimenez. He threw 221.2 innings pitching for the Rockies, which we may not see that again. 288 ERA, 214 strikeouts, a 161 ERA plus. He put up a 7.5 BWAR as a Rockies pitcher somehow. He went 19-8 that year, but he lost to Roy Halladay, who won 20 games. Also had an incredible season. But the thing that really blew me away, it's the first line here. 25 of the 33 games that Ubaldo Jimenez threw had a game score of 50 or higher. In other words, he was good to great. 90%, almost 90% of the time that year. The consistency thing about the situation is, now we saw over the course of his career, it didn't pan out for him, but the first 4 years of Ubaldo Jimenez, and that was really the
it didn't pan out for him in Cleveland either.
Yeah. Right. And he went to these other environments where theoretically it should be easier to pitch, and he wasn't a better pitcher. He just didn't have it anymore, right? The two, and we touched on this too, it's the automatic. What does Coors Field automatically do to you? I don't think it automatically does anything. And I used two hitters to try to talk about that in the article. One was Marco Scudero in 2012. We all remember that. I wonder if any of you have specific memories of that year, because he played 95 games here. Hit 10 points under his career, 20 points less of on-base, 20 points less of slugging. He got traded to the Giants.
Exploded.
Exploded.
Yeah.
I mean, when you see his...
Wasn't he like the LCS MVP or something?
Yeah. He was. Yeah. He was the NLCS MVP. And this year we've seen it, I think, a little bit with Daniel Murphy, who has been under his career numbers across the board. There was an injury thing there, but he just... It doesn't. It didn't automatically. So there's the old, you know, add 20%. Coors Field will add 20%. So in your mind, take off 20%. Where's the 20% for Scudero and Murphy?
Well, let's remember when Murphy was first signed. Everybody's like, "Oh, the gaps at Coors. Oh, he's going to take such advantage of that."
I was one of those people.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, we all were. It was like, "Oh, no brainer," you know. And to my buddy, that's baseball. You know, I mean, it really is, because it's not an automatic thing. If you're playing here after the games, it's not an automatic. You still got to hit the baseball. You still got to be on track. You still got to do everything that you got to do to be a good baseball player.
The line in the Todd Helton section that I had, we were talking about places like, so this was number two on the list, and I want to get everyone's thoughts on Todd Helton's year 2000 campaign. Where were you when? But we all know he was trying to hit 400 going into that final month, right? And it hadn't been done since Ted Williams in 41. When you're chasing history like that, and you're talking about the mound has changed size, guys used to play in the polo grounds, like, at what point can Coors, like, you can't include Coors Field in that, right? But you just know if Todd had finished and hit 400, they'd have said, oh, yeah, he did it, but he did it at Coors Field. So thoughts on that, but also just what do you remember from that season, Ed? Like, that was,
well,
he hit 512 in May.
He was phenomenal. And I think, I don't know how you guys will feel about this, but I'm just going to say it. I think if you took Helton from that year and moved him to 1955, right? He's in the Hall of Fame now, no question about it. I mean, with the numbers he had, with the way he performed year in and year out, I think that to me was one of the most exciting, fun seasons of baseball to watch because of him. And I think even for people who weren't necessarily baseball fans, you can't ignore something like that, you know? It's like when you think back to 2007, 21 out of 22. You know, how often does something like that happen? How often does something like 2000 and Helton happen?
Yeah. He was hitting .395 going into September.
Oh, he had a magnificent year and took advantage of wherever he was. And, you know, it's like, well, it's for a higher average at home. Most people play better at home.
Yeah.
Because they adapt to their environment and they play better there. Why do you think teams usually have better home records than they do road records?
Even in sports where the playing fields are exactly the same.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, you go back to MVP voting, and this goes to a lot of what you wrote. You know, you kind of have to adjust your parameters in terms of what. Going back and thinking about what the writers were thinking about me. You know, they're not looking at war, they're not looking at advanced metrics and all that stuff that they look at now to kind of say, which is why Larry Walker, for example, is getting more consideration. But even then, you go back to the year 2000, and for the sake of putting it out there, Helton's beam war was
8.9,
which led the National League. And the winner that year was Jeff Kent of the Giants, and his was 7.2.
That's significantly.
You've got to think about it this way. I mean, Helton had a higher value, added more value to his team than Barry Bonds did for his, Mike Piazza did for his. These are Jeff Bagwell, you know, Chipper Jones, these names, and he, you know, he finishes fifth, which is not even close. I mean, he should be at least second or third if you look at the raw numbers. And, you know, the raw numbers that they would have been looking at
is fifth.
372, 463, 698 with 42 home runs, 147 RBIs. And the fact that you said he was hitting almost 400 going into the last month of the season where he kind of dipped. It's, you know, again, I wouldn't look at that and base everything off that because we have other numbers that are to me are more precise and they give you a better idea of how much value he brought. But if you're looking at those numbers, same with Bichette, 95, 40 homers, led the league in hits, led the league in slugging. His team got to the playoffs. These are the things that they're looking at, right? And Barry Larkin won the MVP award that year. So it's there's a bias. It's clear. And even by the numbers that they would have been looking at then, they are penalizing Rockies hitters way too much, as in, we don't know how to quantify this yet. And even though now
so
we
let's
do that,
just
even
kind of.
Even though now we do know how to quantify, we're still penalizing Rockies hitters, right? Maybe more than we should. But back then, it's probably more an issue to penalize them because, like, it's like it's a vague thing. They played a course. I don't know.
372 is probably not real.
There's a lot of difference between being player of the year and most valuable player.
Yeah.
If your team's not in the postseason, you're not the most valuable player because your value in baseball is if you get to October. So I would disagree with that point. Now, and that's why I think it's great that the players have their player of the year award. And that's where just a single individual great season matters. But if you're good enough that you make your team finish third instead of fifth, you're not that valuable.
Well, you know, that's a whole other discussion. I think we can go 2 or 3 hours on just what does MVP mean. And that's been had. Obviously, Tracy and I disagree.
All right, I'm going to have to cut the conversation off there, at least for now, for this part, the first half of this episode of an All-Star Panel Conversation. We'll pick it up right there where we left off with Ringlesby and Manny mostly trying to define MVPs and getting into the analytics versus old school debate. Ed jumps in with some really good stuff. Patrick Lyons joins the conversation. We keep it going. We absolutely did not stop there, but I have got to stop it there so that we can have this be a reasonably sized file. So I want to thank you all for listening into this one. Hope you go right forward and listen to the next one. I'm hoping to have them out very close to each other so you don't have to wait too much in between episodes, but I do have some editing to do. So thank you for listening. Make sure you're following us on social media, at BSN Rockies, at Drew Priestman, at Patrick D. Lyons. So you can give us a like, share, and subscribe on Facebook or whatever podcast app you happen to be using. Make sure you swing over to BSNDenverMerch.com. And of course, continue to be absolutely awesome. I will continue to be absolutely Drew Priestman. And until next time, I will see you at the ball. Hey, as you guys may or may not know, taking care of your teeth is pretty important. Our friends at Green Mountain Dental Group are giving away a free Sonicare toothbrush when you schedule a cleaning, x-ray, or exam. That's right. You simply have to take care of your teeth for Green Mountain Dental to hand over a free Sonicare. Check them out today online or call 303-988-0711 to schedule your appointment.